we can first of all, we can approach this question in a polemic way, and then approach it in a in an intellectual and a rational way. And when we approach it in a polemic way, we have to see this: is Islam really more violent than other religions or not? It's interesting to note that a software engineer, he analyzed the Quran and the Bible. He analyzed them and to see which one was more violent. And he found that, it's interesting to note that in his processing of these two holy books, to see which one was the most violent, in conclusion, he wrote this. This person, his name was Tom Anderson. He was a software engineer. He said that this project was inspired by the ongoing public debate around whether or not terrorism connected with Islamic fundamentalism reflects something inherently and distinctly violent about Islam compared to other major religions or not. It just took about 2 minutes for his software to analyze these two books. But he found that, surprisingly, the Old Testament was far more violent than the New Testament, and more than twice as violent as the Quran. Mr. Anderson summarized his conclusion in the following way. He said that killing and destruction are referenced slightly more often in the New Testament, 2.8%, than in the Quran, 2.1%. But the Old Testament clearly leads more than twice that of the Quran in mentions of destruction and killing, 5.3%. He adds, first I want to make it very clear that we have not set out to prove or disprove that Islam is more violent than other religions. Moreover, we realized that the Old and New Testaments and the Quran are neither the only literature in Islam and Christianity and Judaism, nor do they constitute the sum of these religions, religious teachings, and protocols. Nevertheless, this is a conclusion that he reached, which is interesting. So polemically, we could say that these texts, which are form the very fundamental and essential sources of doctrine in these religions, right? We see that polemically, we could say that these two texts, which are the sources of Judeo-Christian faith, statistically, we can say that there are references to violent concepts within the sacred scriptures, such as death, killing, destruction, the destruction of nations, and so on and so forth. But if we were to use this as a measure of a book which is violent, and of violence or not, we would have to say that, no, the other Abrahamic scriptures are more violent than the Quran. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at violence and the Quran and Islam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Aga, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Midstream.
Israeli occupation forces face a real challenge in the city and camp of Jenin, up north of the city, where the Israeli aggression is being met with the form of resistance that scares Israel the most: live bullets and homemade Molotov instead of the good old rocks. The last of these clashes occurred at dawn last Monday when the occupation forces infiltrated to arrest a Palestinian young man, but an armed clash erupted, resulting in the martyrdom of 5 Palestinians. Activists in the camp made their stance very clear as they announced that resistance fighters from all factions are ready to clash with the Israeli army whenever they storm their camp. Since September 6th, the West Bank and Gaza Strip have gone through daily confrontations and clashes between Palestinian natives and the Israeli occupation after the heroic escape of the six Palestinian detainees from the Gilboa prison. In the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank, in retaliation to the continuous Israeli aggression, dozens of shootings targeted Al Jalama checkpoint, homemade bombs were thrown, and bullets targeted an Israeli military occupation camp in the Mount Gerizim in Nablus. Also, dozens of clashes involved stones and Molotov cocktails took place in different parts of the West Bank. Anger mounted in the Palestinian streets after Israel recaptured and tortured four of the hero detainees, especially Zakaria Zubaydi, the former commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, who ended up with a fracture in the face due to the Israeli brutality. All Palestinian factions praised the escalated confrontations in Al-Quds and the West Bank, considering them as the only option to force Israel to end its violations against the Palestinian natives and those illegally held as captives in Israeli detention centers. Meanwhile, former commander of the Jenin unit in the occupation army, Yair Falau, confirmed that the city of Jenin and its camp still houses the nucleus of the Palestinian resistance in the occupied territories. This statement comes 20 years after the invasion carried out by the occupation army against the city and the West Bank under the name of the Defensive Wall. Falau suggested that the occupation army may carry out Operation Defensive Wall 2 within 6 months to a year if the situation continues as it is in Jenin. Yes, there is no comparison between the capabilities of the Israeli occupation forces and those of the resistance. But the will of the people and resistance fighters who have been going through hard times cannot be broken. They do not fear any threat. The Israeli army might be ready to storm the camp, awaiting a political decision, yet the resistance fighters in the camp will make them pay for it. Any price, no matter how low it is, will shake the Bennett government. This army cannot stand the killing of one or two of its occupation soldiers. Go figure what happens if scores of them start falling. The world has witnessed in front row seats the current generation in the occupied territories defending Palestine. Natives of Al-Quds and Jenin camp do not have any fears and are ready for any Israeli aggression. The proof is that they daily go to the Al-Jalama checkpoint and clash with the occupation. They are not waiting for the occupation to storm the camp. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Now, in the West Bank, the Israeli occupation forces face a real challenge in the city of Jenin in the north, where they are met with retaliatory live bullets rather than rocks, as in other areas when Zionists storm the rest of the West Bank. They are faced usually with stones being thrown at them by young men, but in Jenin, natives fire live ammunition at the occupation forces and armed clashes erupt. The last of these clashes occurred at dawn last Monday when the occupation forces penetrated to arrest the Palestinian youth and an armed clash erupted, resulting in the death of five Palestinians. It was not enough killings for Israelis that they later on Thursday morning, they killed a 30-year-old mother of four, Isra Huzaima, near Bab al-Silsila, a gate in occupied Al-Quds. Now, Isra, who is from southern Jenin, was accused without evidence by the Israeli occupation forces that she was trying to stab one of the soldiers. The city of Jenin and its camp still possesses the nucleus of Palestinian resistance in the occupied territories after 20 years of the invasion carried out by the occupation army on the city and the West Bank under the name of the Protective Fence. Now, this fence is falling apart, and Jenin will be the first to crush it. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate and member of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Amal. Now, dozens of Palestinian gunmen roam the streets of the West Bank, especially the Jenin refugee camp in the northern West Bank, that they say that they are ready to repel any kind of Israeli aggression or invasion against the camp. And they even called for a joint operation. All factions inside the camp called for a joint operation for the first time in many, many years. It includes the military wings affiliated with the National Liberation Movement, Fatah, with the Islamic Resistance, Hamas, and with the Islamic Jihad as well. Now, clashes have led recently to the martyrdom of several Palestinian young men and women. How has that affected the morale of the people inside of the camp?
Thank you, Marwa, for having me. Of course, it's affecting the morale of the people in Jenin, and it's not only Jenin. It's affecting the people of Palestine inside and outside the occupied territories. So any defiance for the Israeli occupation army and forces is actually a unifying stance by all the people and backed by all the people. Jenin refugee camp is considered to be liberated, as we call it, as the militant from the joint operation room is calling it, because the Israelis cannot enter the camp and cannot go with military forces to arrest anybody within the camp, even in the surrounding villages of Jenin. Any entrance or any insurgent by the Israeli military forces is going to be confronted with joint operation room, with joint militants from different Palestinian resistance groups to fight these Israelis. So it's not something that is going to be away by the Israeli wishes or even by any insurgent by the Israeli military forces. It's going to be defied, it's going to be resisted, and it's going to be actually causing them lots of casualties if they dare to enter the camp or to enter any of the villages.
Well, Dr. Ahmad, we heard from a former commander of the Jenin unit in the occupation army. He said his name is Yad Flau, and he confirmed that the city of Jenin and its camp, it still possesses the nucleus of the resistance of the occupied territories in occupied Palestine. And he somehow threatened that there will be a new defensive war. He called it Operation Defensive World 2. Might happen again, similar to the one that happened in 2002, within 6 months to a year, if the situation continues as is in Jenin camp. Now, is this just cheap talk by this Falau person, or actually, because he's expected to be soon the commander of the Golani brigade in the army, or is Israel actually ready to commit a new genocide?
Well, committing genocide is there, the pattern is the process of this colonial apartheid entity since day one, even before 1948. So we wouldn't be surprised if they carry on any genocide against any of the Palestinian communities in the West Bank or Jerusalem. But the thing is, if we want to compare what happened 20 years ago and now in terms of accumulation of power, accumulation of willingness to defy the Israelis, even in the ability of the militants to fight the Israeli, Israeli insurgents or invasion, and if we compare what happened to the Israeli side after 20 years, we can see that the balance of power now is weighing towards the Palestinian resistance, the Palestinian militant.
Well, the observers of the conditions of Jenin camp and Al-Quds are believing that the Jenin camp right now looks a lot like the besieged Gaza Strip, which the Israeli army is unable to invade, just like you said right now. Now, reports suggest that the resistance fighters from different areas of the West Bank actually arrived into Jenin camp in trying to prevent the invasion and preparing for a battle against the Israeli enemy. What are the odds of a joint Gaza/occupied territories operation in the event that Israel actually goes and invades Jenin camp?
Well, that's the thing. If they dare to invade the Jenin refugee camp, I am sure that the resistance in Gaza will also stand up with Jenin and the rest of the West Bank as well. Remember that we still have the popular resistance everywhere, mm-hmm. and we witnessed what happened in Beit Anan, Jerusalem, over a week ago when they invaded one of the villages in Jerusalem, and the militants stood up for them. Of course, they were more in numbers, and it cost us two martyrs, actually. But at the end, the will of the people to resist the occupation is increasing and is accelerating.
That brings to mind a very important question, since we have one more minute left. How do you think the Palestinian Authority, will deal in the situation in case there is an escalation inside of Jenin and the popular resistance goes up, stands in the face of the occupation?
Actually, Al-Aqsa Brigades had chosen their side. They're with the resistance, and they are together with the other factions in the military operation room. So the PA has no choice except to stand by the resistance. Otherwise, it will be looking very bad in front of the eyes of the people, of the Palestinians here. They do not have any choice except to support the resistance, to support their Aqsa Brigade.
That's the national stance
that they should take if they want to stay in power a little bit longer.
Thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate and member of the Global Gathering in support of the choice of the resistance, for being with us. And whether Palestine resists or not, we stand by the side of Palestine and by the right to defend their own soil and their liberties. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Bahrain opened a new Israeli embassy and how the population, the public, is revolting against it.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
The first official visit by an Israeli minister, Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, inaugurated the Israeli embassy in Manama and met the Bahraini King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. Now, the official Bahraini news agency reported that King Hamad reviewed with Lapid the course of bilateral relations and the steps that contribute to the strengthening areas of cooperation between the two countries in light of the signing of the Declaration of Support for Peace and the Abraham Accord Agreement. Yes. He said peace, while Palestine just held several different funeral processions last week alone for the natives that were killed by the occupation's bullets. No shame whatsoever. The visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Bahrain can be summed up in one word: treason. This is how the Bahraini people feel about it, and how every Arab, Muslim, and free soul on this planet actually feels. No king, emir, or president will ever be able to remove Palestine from the hearts and minds of the people, and they will all never wash the stain of this crime from their hands. Al-Khalifa regime betrays Palestine in this following report.
Demonstrations against normalization continue in Bahrain, coinciding with the visit of the Israeli entity's foreign minister Yair Lapid, voicing their refusal to open an Israeli embassy on their soil. The Bahraini security forces had suppressed similar demonstrations in the capital, Manama, and in several cities after they roamed the streets condemning normalization during the past week. On the day of the visit, Bahraini National Initiative Against Normalization affirmed its complete rejection of normalization with the usurping entity. The initiative considered in a statement under the title No Welcome to the Occupying Criminal that Lapid's desecration of Bahrain's land comes in light of the strong rejection of the proud Bahraini people who remain loyal to their central cause, pointing out that the Palestinian cause is the compass of the conflict in the region and that the Israeli entity is a satanic seed that has been planted in the side of the Arab world to keep the latter in a state of permanent depletion, keeping it away from progress, development, and prosperity. The initiative called on the authorities of Bahrain to immediately stop slipping towards normalization, which constitutes a stab in the back of the Palestinian people and its active forces and its militant factions, calling on all groups of the Bahraini people to renew their rejection of this normalization with the enemy and to continue to stand by the Palestinian people and support them in order to liberate their land and establish their independent national state on their entire national territory with Al-Quds as their official capital. Meanwhile, all Palestinian factions and pro-resistance factions across the Arab and Islamic world condemned this act of normalization by the Bahraini rogue regime, summing up the visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Bahrain in one word: treason. All the while, Bahrain's King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa blatantly considered that his country's normalization with the Israeli occupation entity is a, quote, historic achievement that contributes to advancing the peace and stability process in the Middle East, end quote. The king's brazen remarks came as Palestine held seven different funeral processions for natives killed by the occupation's bullets during the same week of the Israeli foreign minister's visit to his country to open the notorious embassy on Bahraini soil.
Now to discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Ali Al-Fayez, Bahraini activist. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Al-Fayez. Now, rogue regimes in multiple Arab countries that had normalized ties with the Israeli entity are pinning their hopes on the U.S., eyeing to please Washington by this kind of normalization, the last of which was actually Bahrain, when it welcomed Israeli foreign minister, as we just saw in the report, Yair Lapid, who inaugurated an Israeli embassy in Manama and met with the Bahraini king, Hamad bin Isa al-Khalifa. Does the king not care whatsoever about the public sentiment in this matter? I mean, is he not concerned about his nation's security in any way possible?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for inviting me. Well, you just said that the Sarog regime, the Al-Khalifa regime, have no legitimacy whatsoever. And the king, so-called king, the ruler of Bahrain, is taking decision on behalf of himself and his family, not on behalf of the people. The people, is against the normalization with the Zionist entity. And our people have protested on the street for the past days, flagging the opposition to such step. Now, when we talk about security and stability, Al-Khalifa does not look at the stability of the country and security of Bahrain, but they look at the security of their regime, the Al-Khalifa ruling regime, and they believe it will be more secured with the relationship with this entity, the Zionist entity, as there is a step from the United States to leave Middle East soon.
Well, Mr. Al-Fayez, the February 14 Revolution Youth Coalition in Bahrain denounced the planned visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Bahrain, holding the Bahraini regime responsible for the consequences of the visit. Now, the coalition also emphasized the need for all forms of resistance against normalization until the concluded normalization agreements are canceled completely with the entity. Can this be understood as a mobilization for the first armed resistance in Bahrain? That's just me asking, because I read it and read it again, and I was like, well, this is new. What do you think?
Well, the leadership of Bahrain movement, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim, decision until this moment is to stay peaceful. Now, this with regard to the democratic transformation that the opposition and the people of Bahrain demanded for the past 10 years, actually more than 10 years, but since the 14th of Feb revolution. Now, with the Zionist regime being in the picture and the equation, this could change the whole equation. But, you know, 14 of Feb coalition or other movement, they have always such option on the table, but they will not take it in a practice unless it's decided by Ayatollah Sheikh Isa, Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim. We will resist politically, we will resist on the media, we will resist on the ground by protesting, but mobilization of all resistance is a decision of Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim, and I would advise everyone to read his statements and to follow what he is saying, because he could take a decision if that's needed to secure Bahrain and the interest of this ummah, the Arabic and Islamic ummah.
Well, Palestine viewed this visit as an encouragement of Israeli crimes against its people. Mind you, on the same week which the visit actually happened, there were seven Palestinian natives that were killed with live bullets by the Israeli entity, one of which actually a 30-year-old mother of four in the occupied Al-Quds. I mean, after such humiliating normalization, what role do these puppet regimes think that they can play to protect Palestine, as they always say they are doing?
Well, that's a fake statement. They always say it to, you know, change the direction of their agenda. Their agenda is to have a relationship with Israel, the Zionist entity, the Zionist regime at this point of time, because the United States have almost reached a decision to withdraw from our region, the Middle East region. The ruler of Bahrain will last think about Palestine. He will never put that in his political calculation at all.
Well, Mr. Al-Fayez, on the outskirts of Manama, as you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, that protesters burned tires, they protested, they tried to voice their let's say they try to be as vocal as possible to say that they do not accept this kind of normalization, especially against the Al-Khalifa regime. We saw a hashtag on social media that says hashtag Bahrain rejects Zionists in Arabic. It was trending all week long. What do you think will be the role of the new Israeli embassy in Manama in the event the opposition decided to face off with the Bahraini regime to inverse this normalization? What can the embassy do when it has a foot inside of Manama?
Well, look, the anger is piling inside Bahrain. The people are very angry. They've been protesting for the past 3-4 days a momentum that's going up high. And we believe the Israeli have come to Bahrain because Al-Khalifa regime needed extra support from United States and Britain to counter the people's demand of democratic transformation. But the interest of the Zionist regime is to counter Iran as a growing power that lead the resistance in our region, in the Middle East region. Now, we hear many statements from Israeli officials as well as Bahraini officials that they will have a military and security ties, and this could lead to a conflict, could lead to make Bahrain as a conflict area. God forbid, if that happened, the Israeli will not be able to defend their ally, Al-Khalifa regime, because they can't defend themselves.
Well, this has to be seen, especially in the upcoming weeks, when protests are being called upon by the Bahraini people and all activists around the world as well to protest against this decision by the Al-Khalifa regime in Bahrain. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Al-Fayez, Bahraini activist, for joining us from London to talk about this issue. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints you are listening to. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum and Sayyid
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. So recently, in two Friday Jummah prayers, in Afghanistan, there have been two bomb blasts, you know, terrorist bomb attacks by the suicide bombers. One of them, which took place first, was in Kunduz, and the other one in Bibi Fatima Mosque in Kandahar. You know, up to now, more than 120 people have been killed in these two incidents, and the Daesh terrorist groups, you know, claim the responsibility of these bombings in these two Shia mosques. But before that, we had these suicide bombing in front of the Sayyid al-Shuhada school, the girls' school in Afghanistan. Really a very sad news. And this attacking of the Afghanistan's Shia minority has a long history. Sayyid Murtaza, let's start with you, brother. It seems that whoever is the administration, the Shia minority are under the attack of these groups over there and are the victims, isn't it so?
Well, of course, yes. You know, in the past at least 25 years, the Shiite minorities all over the country have been attacked deliberately and on purpose. Many analysts have brought some justifications. They have mentioned that Shiite minority is the primary target for terrorist groups such as Daesh and previously Taliban themselves.
Yes.
Attacked, you know, carried out such a deadly attacks on Shiite sites. Unfortunately, Shiite minority have not been considered as one important segment of the Afghan society. They have been treated like marginalized people and marginalized groups. Even Shiite political parties,
yes,
have not been given the first primary attention by the ex-government in Afghanistan.
Yes.
So terrorist groups, in order to prove and confirm their strong presence on the ground, they look for a very swift, easy targets.
No.
And Shiite minorities are the one they are after.
Why is it so? Why so swift, you know, and easy to target?
Unfortunately, you know, in order to have a strong presence in the political system in the country, you need to have some representatives. And Shiite minorities, unfortunately, have not had such a tool in order to prove that they have had so far the strong presence.
Yes.
So terrorist groups look for the easy targets, and unfortunately, these mosques, madrasas, schools, any gathering sites belong to Shiite groups have been attacked over the past 25 years.
Right.
And even the American themselves took many Shiite people as their hostages when they were just carrying out those night attacks across the country. So we can simply see that Shiites have been the primary target for all terrorist groups and the ex-government officials, just to show that there is a kind of absolute majority of the Sunni's government.
That's
and
right.
They are not going to consider other minorities as part of the society and the political system.
That's all right. So thank you, Sayyid Mohsen. So Sayyid Mohsen, what would be the solution to this problem? I mean, aren't they going to recognize the Shiite groups and the Shiite minority as a legitimate group who are living in Afghanistan for so many years? I think they are called by the name of Hazara?
Well, you know, there are many different races,
okay,
with ethnicities, I
yes,
mean, living
yes.
in Afghanistan. Hazaras is one of them. But mostly Shiite, you know, are coming from the
Hazara
ethnicities.
Yes, that's right. So what would be the solution to this problem, you know? And so many people are killed nowadays. The children, look at the girls, you know, the innocent girls that has been killed inside the Shahada school for the bomb attacks, Kunduz and Kandahar, you know, and the media coverage in Afghanistan has always been, you know, on the
biased.
Top, yeah, the bias, you know. They say nowadays that the Shias have been bombed or this and that. We have never heard that the Sunni gathering is bombed in Afghanistan. You know, it's really strange news. So what's happening, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, obviously we know that in Islam, the enemies always wanted to inject some propagandas, and the takfirism is one of them.
Yes.
Takfirism means like you claim another group which is not same as you being kafir or disbelievers.
Okay.
And since in Afghanistan, obviously, the religious groups who are in Afghanistan, especially the Talib or Taliban, they belong to the Islamic seminaries of Ahl Sunnah, and not just Ahl Sunnah, because within Ahl Sunnah we have different categories.
Yes.
There are different school of thoughts. One of them, which is the extremist groups, they're known as the Wahhabis and Murtafiris.
Yes.
We can see, like, initially when against Russia, when they came, the Soviet Union,
yes,
when Taliban entered into, yes, the Afghanistan at the time of Ziaul Haq, when he was the chief in Pakistan or the general in Pakistan. At that time, the Islamic seminaries who belonged to the Takfiri school of thought, especially Wahhabism or the Saudi, we can say, backed,
yes,
Islamic seminaries, who considered Shias as kafir, they entered the Afghanistan. And they had, obviously, when they entered Afghanistan, they started to root their own ideologies within the Afghan Taliban, the Afghan, we can say, Islamic seminary schools. Even before that, yes, we can see there was killing of Shias, but obviously it was two-way. They used to protect each other because, you know, when you go towards the borderline of the northern area of Pakistan, where it's Peshawar, and then we have the border of Afghanistan, there also we can see there's a dispute between the Shia and Sunni.
Mm-hmm.
And it was from before.
Yes.
But obviously this thing has blamed up, and obviously the things has grown. We can say, like, the weapons and the accessories were given to the Taliban.
That's right.
And then obviously Shia got weakened and weakened.
Yes.
And the point which brother has raised, that's true. Like, you know, in order to show your power, you look for the weak ones.
Yes.
And you always beat the weak ones. So when we talk about the solution is obviously we need to change. There must be a change of mentality, because, you know, if Taliban claims to follow the Quran, if they claim to follow the Sunnah of the Prophet, then obviously even if the minorities which you think they are non-believers, there is a protection for them in your country. You know, in Islam we have the rule of jizya.
Yes.
I'm just talking, I'm not saying like the Shias are the kafir or disbelievers, I'm not saying this. I'm talking on the grounds of the Quran, that the Quran has introduced jizya for the non-believers.
Even non-believers, they will give, have, yes, rights, that's right. Okay.
They have the rights, and the ruler of the country should protect,
yes,
them.
Okay.
So this is what we see. Even, yes, at the time of the Prophet, when we look at the history, Prophet did not kill the Jews or non-Muslims in Medina. Okay.
Yes.
When he was in the Mecca, he never, raised his sword against the non-believers. He, with his wordings, has called them towards the true Islam. So, you know, there are the, basically, it depends, and it is depending on their beliefs which they have.
That's right.
So,
but obviously, the story now is different because the Taliban has got the power, you know. The Taliban used to bomb attack the Shia mosques before. Now they have the power, and they see these bomb attacks from the time of ISIS, from the side of ISIS, okay? And really, one of the spokesmen called ISIS, you know, not a threat, but a headache. It means there are so many commonalities and similarities between the two. But I think the Taliban, if they want to have the power in Afghanistan, they have to recognize the Shias minority as a legitimate group, isn't it?
Well, actually, in order to have stability in the country, Taliban now is in control,
yes,
of the country.
Yes.
They have to consider a lasting, inclusive, and actually political settlement of the issues. Otherwise, this clash will go on for another 20 years, 30 years, because even minority groups such as Shiites have access to all types of weapons. So now it's like Shiites are waiting to see how Taliban are going to rule the country.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is not going to be stopped, and if this is not going to be considered by Taliban as a threat to other minority groups, I think in very near future, we will have some kind of uprising across the country.
That's
so
right.
It is for Taliban to think how they can provide protection to minority groups such as Shiites. So I think the lasting stability of the country all goes back how Taliban is going to form and construct their policies towards and against groups.
And do they believe at all in the official settlement? I mean, like the other countries have, like the parliament or having ministries or something like that?
Well, I've just listened to an interview a couple of days ago. Because many other countries demanded Taliban to form an inclusive government.
Yes.
The response to such an international request, Taliban said, well, we will have a government and we will have members from all ethnicities in our government system. But international community should not ask us for an inclusive government.
Mm-hmm.
So this statement is a very strong statement.
Okay.
It means that they are going to construct a government based on their own ideologies, based on their beliefs,
yes.
and they are not going to follow modern way of ruling the country.
That's
like
right.
Any other parts of the world.
That's all right. And really, it makes more clear the strategic failure of the U.S. because 20 years ago, after these 9/11 attacks in the U.S., they claimed that we want to attack terrorism in Afghanistan and Iraq. So one of their targets was Taliban, for sure. Is it so? So after 20 years, now the Taliban is ruling and Americans. So what does it mean? I don't understand.
Well, of course, we all know the fact on the ground sometimes looks very much different from the general picture. Principles.
Yes.
America went into Afghanistan to fight Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
Because 9/11 was a strategic event that took place in the recent history of America.
Yes.
So they went there to take out Al-Qaeda. And besides, Taliban were involved.
Yes.
So now after 20 years, America can see that their first target was not achieved.
Mm-hmm.
They lost a lot. They are still losing. No one is going to trust America any longer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Afghan nation is the biggest loser.
Loser and victim, that's right.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, that's all right. So
I can just add something about the history as well. We should not forget the role of British and America in the Shia killings in Afghanistan or Pakistan or any place in the world. Why? Because we know that the Ali Saud was made by the Britishers. They have backed them up. And what I can remember, like in the initial war against the Soviet Union, these Taliban groups in the Pakistan, obviously, they were also backed up by the Saudi Arabia.
That's all right.
And you know that the Saudi Arabia has a takfiri, like thinking and
yes.
killing.
Yes.
Even the Al-Qaeda members, which were nominated by the Americans, most of them were the Saudi Arabian nationals. And we know that, obviously, this takfirism, this killing and the thoughts has come from Saudi Arabia. If I can just refer to the history, we can see, like in Pakistan, there was a peace until the Taliban was obviously erased. And the Sunni used to marry Shia, and the Shia used to marry Sunnis. There are many examples in Pakistan. But since this thing has started, the things of Taliban, the whole situation changed. And now we can see, that the Shias were killed even in Pakistan by the
yes.
the Al-Qaeda groups or Daesh or even the Pakistani Taliban.
Oh.
You know, in Pakistan today, we have many people who claim to be the Pakistani Taliban. For example, in Islamabad, there is a mosque whose imam is the leader of the Pakistani Taliban, because now they're in two different groups, like Pakistani Taliban and Afghanistani Taliban. And this guy has given a statement that in the month of Muharram, because Taliban has provided some protection to the processions of the Shias
yes.
for their own ceremonies, they were against it, the Taliban in Pakistan.
Oh.
So we can see like this takfiri thought, which is backed by the Saudi Arabia, you can see it highly on a high level in Pakistan and at a low level now when Taliban is in power.
Yes.
That's the only difference.
Yeah.
A low level.
Yeah,
but
they will face many questions
yeah.
and ambiguities now because they've got a power.
Well, let me just
you
wanna
answer
add to my brother. opinion, you know, Taliban actually didn't fight Soviet Union war in Afghanistan. Some of the Taliban members were called Mujahideens,
mm-hmm.
and they were freedom fighters.
Yes.
But during the Soviet war in Afghanistan, there was no group by the name of Taliban. So Taliban was created around 1994, I think, by the financial help of Saudi Arabia and the logistic help from Pakistan and the American, actually, policy. So all these three countries came together to create a group that can actually protect their benefits and rights.
That's right.
So Taliban actually didn't have a presence in the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And you do know that the only solution to the current situation in Afghanistan is the recognition of peace agreement among all political national groups in Afghanistan.
That's
Taliban
right.
is in charge, but Taliban knows very well by heart that they cannot rule the country alone. They need to form and reform and restructure their own institutions
That's
in
right.
order to give a chance to peace to be established.
That's
so
right.
I think Taliban for sure knows that the situation
right.
will differ in
okay.
future.
We will talk more about the Taliban and the Taliban's behavior. Is it really changed? In upcoming session of the program, that's all we have time for today's discussion. Said Murtaza, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Said Mohsen.
Yeah.
Dear brothers and sisters, thank you much for listening to us. This is Real Points. I am Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Khan of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Khan of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanat.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful,
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. For such is the state of the disbelievers, until when death comes to one of them, he says, My Lord, send me back. That I might do righteousness in that which I left behind. No, it is only a word he is saying, and behind them is a barrier until the day they are resurrected.
Brothers and sisters, regarding these two verses, the Almighty Allah says, حتى إذا جاء أحدهم الموت قال رب ارجعون, until when death comes unto one of them, he says, My Lord, send me back again. And the next verse where it says, لَعَلِّي أَعْمَلُ صَالِحًا فِيمَا تَرَكْتْ, that I might do righteous in that of which I have left behind. At the end it says, وَمِن وَرَائِهِمْ بَرْزَخْ, but behind them is a partition, إِلَى يَوْمِ يُبْعَثُونَ, until the day when they shall be raised up. Speaking of barzakh or partition, we have concluded previously that it is a thing, a kind of stage that is standing between the two things, and in this case, it is standing between this world and the Day of Judgment, and it is not just for the good people or the bad people, it is for both of them. Also, by starting to have a look at the different traditions of the infallibles, we found out that sometimes it is the grave itself. This is how barzakh is referred to in some of the traditions, and it means that the punishments and rewards given between this world and the hereafter is the grave or barzakh itself. Let's look at some of the other traditions of the infallibles, explaining more about this concept of barzakh. Another tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that one day a man came to him and said, It is said that the souls of the believers after death will enter the chests of green birds that fly around the divine throne. The Imam said, No, that is not the case. The believer is more respectable in the eyes of Allah than to be confined within the chest of a bird. The souls of believers are rather clothed in bodies like their own bodies of this world. So, this tradition, dear listeners, is referring to a substantial body that is somehow like this material body here, but it is as immaterial as the intermediate world they are living in that time.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. There is also another tradition cited in the Book of Kafi attributed to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. The Imam was asked about the souls of the believers, and he answered, "They are in the chambers of paradise. They eat the foods of paradise, and they drink its drinks. They say, 'O Allah, establish the day of resurrection and make the promises you have made to us come to pass.'" So this is explicitly suggesting that they are living in a stage, they are getting their rewards of good deeds and righteousness in this world, and they are asking the Almighty Allah to even make His promises come to pass by starting the day of resurrection, by establishing that day of resurrection. There is yet another tradition by the Imam in the same book, where he says that when a believer passes away, the souls of the believers will gather around him, the other believers, and ask him about those who were in the world and whether they were alive or dead. If he says that such and such a person had died, but they did not see him among themselves, they will say that that person had certainly fallen, which means he has gone into hell. So certainly paradise and hell in the narrations that we talked about are not real ones. They are the states in the intermediate world, close to hell or close to paradise. And they are not those that after the day of judgment the people will experience. So overall, many narrations speak of the pressure and punishment of the grave and the questions put to its inhabitants. Many narrations talk about the contact of the souls of the dead with their families and observing the conditions therein. And there are also some narrations mentioning the incidents that had happened to the Prophet ﷺ on the night of his ascension and his meeting with the souls of the prophets and messengers. They are all suggesting that there is a kind of stage called Barzakh, or the intermediate world. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, all the lies and treachery that is cruel, but oh,